I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guests today are Jeff Miller, chef owner of Rosella and Bar Miller in East Village, New York, and James Jumapit, executive chef at Bar Miller. They both worked at Uchiko in Austin, Texas, which is one of the most influential sushi restaurants in America. In 2017, Jeff opened Payanoki, the first sustainable sushi restaurant in New York, with his business partner, TJ Provenzano, and they join us in episode 129 to discuss their unique philosophy. And since then, their business did evolve into Rosella, which earned many accolades and was named one of the best new restaurants in America by Esquire magazine in 2021. James joined Rosella shortly after its opening. And if in September 2023, the team opened the Bar Miller, the 8-seat omakase-only sushi bar, where James leads the entire sushi bar with a pleasant energy and offers exciting culinary discoveries. And along with the expansion of the team's business, Jeff has been deepening his knowledge and experience of serving sustainable sushi. So today we'll discuss the meaning and importance of sustainable sushi, the overlooked delicious and sustainable seafood you should try, challenges and advantages of running sustainable sushi restaurants, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We truly appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Jeff Miller and James Jumapit. Hello, Jeff. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, we have a huge topic and huge questions to ask you. So, to get to know you first, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up? Maybe Jeff first.
I grew up in Grass Valley, California, in the Sierra foothills in Northern California. I grew up eating whatever my mom made. The highlights for me tended to be macaroni and cheese, and her lasagna. She was way ahead of the curve with avocado toast. She was making open-faced avocado and cheese sandwiches for years in my childhood. So that's at the top of the list.
Yeah, it cannot be more Californian than that, I guess. So what about James?
Yeah, I grew up in all over New Jersey, really. And I actually had a pretty great culinary kind of childhood. My father is an avid cook. He owned like a small food trailer when I was growing up, that kind of thing. And he was just constantly cooking and experimenting. Most of the time we had two dinners, and always seafood was involved. So I've kind of had a burgeoning interest in seafood for my whole life, basically.
Mm. I like the idea of two dinners. Yeah. And so how did you get into cooking and particularly sushi? And could you tell us where you trained yourself also?
I got into cooking professionally in 2007 in Gainesville, Florida. I was I moved to Florida to go to the University of Florida, and needed a job. And I'd heard, at this point in my life, I was just becoming obsessed with sushi as a diner. And I had this idea that it would be fun to learn. And I took a chance and went into this restaurant in downtown Gainesville called Dragonfly. And they hired me, and I worked my way up there over a period of 5 years until I graduated. And that's after that is when I moved to Texas.
Mm. And joined Uchiko under Tyson Cole.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's funny that listeners, if you want to have the details of how Jeff got a job without any previous sushi making experience professionally, you have to listen to 129. But basically,
it was very lucky. I had no business getting that job. It was really a product of a misunderstanding.
Right. So basically, the owner misunderstood you as the person I was supposed to come on, then you kind of took over the position. I don't know what happened to that guy. But, right. So what about you, James?
Yeah. So I started in Texas at Uchi, out of culinary school. But I started in the hot kitchen first. So initially I was kind of the pantry cook. I was a stodge. I worked my way up. But I always had my eyes on the sushi bar as kind of the end game, and definitely admired what they did. And it seemed so exotic and different, and like it seemed like something I could never be good at, honestly. And that made me want it even more. So within a year, I made my way up to kind of like the lowest station on the sushi bar. And by the third year, I was pretty much running the sushi bar over there. And that's when Uchiko opened. And not too long after that, Jeff and I met and obviously started our kind of a professional relationship and friendship.
Right. Yeah. So, and I heard that you worked at the Asian Smokehouse, and you have a very huge experience, not just a Japanese sushi kitchen. So that makes it even more interesting. Looking at what you do at the Bamila too. So, okay, so this is a question for Jeff, I guess. So you have been serving sustainable sushi for a long time at this point. And when and why did you decide to focus on serving sustainable sushi?
I guess it was a slow process, but the best way to summarize it, I think, is that it's more interesting. And it's not the sustainability of it that's more interesting. The sustainability element of what we do to me is a bit like keeping the kitchen clean. Like it's something that's assumed. It's not really something that I feel like needs to be a focal point. What was really appealing to me was because of where I'm from and where I've lived, making sushi using seafood from the nearest sources possible. And that was so difficult for me at first, in part because I didn't know what seafood, like what fish even existed out here, with the exception of, you know, the most obvious fish. But even after that, once I started to familiarize myself with the fish that I could get, I didn't know when they would be in season or the best ways to prepare them. So for the first few years at Mayanoki, it was like kind of relearning sushi. But it's the best part for me, the goal, or essentially I think what we've created, is sushi that is a genuine or some sort of authentic reflection of who we are and where we are.
Well, that's the very essence of sushi in the Japanese definition, right? Because it's local, sustainable. What's available goes into sushi.
If you and I've only been to Japan a couple of times, but there's not a ton. If you go into a restaurant there, in my experience, there's a so much attention to detail in terms of like where every single ingredient is from. And it's not like there's a bunch of imported ingredients there. It's from different parts of Japan. And I think if you go to any number of high-end sushi restaurants in New York or in America, it's this, and there are some great ones. I love them, but it's kind of an attempt to recreate the Japanese experience as opposed to taking that philosophy and applying it to something here.
Right. Or as the ironically, the essence that we just talked about, the local sustainable fish goes into your dinner table, it's kind of because of the, you know, appreciation of Toyosu market fish. Everybody ships far away from Japan and overnight, thank you, FedEx or whatever. And in the end, you have to pay for it, which is not the healthy way to democratize this sushi. This sushi was supposed to be eaten locally, sustainably. So yeah, there's something wrong with it. And I think you guys are trying to kind of change the whole direction of the energy it was supposed to happen. So I really admire. So what is sustainable seafood by definition? What are your criteria for sustainable seafood at your restaurant, Rosella and Van Mueller?
I'll just give the most succinct answer I can. We divide seafood into two categories, wild caught or farmed. If they're farmed, what we look for is fish that are farmed typically in inland farms. So like the gold standard there is called RAS, recirculating aquaculture systems, so that there are so there's no damage to surrounding ecosystems or pollution of surrounding waters. They're over the course of being open, we've served some fish from offshore farms. What we look for there is like very low density farms that are managed with the goal of keeping the surrounding environment clean. When it comes to wild caught fish, the catch method is important. The goal there being to catch what is being targeted, as opposed to just kind of catching fish indiscriminately. So the best option there is like single line caught fish, where you're going out for one kind of fish and reeling it in. But there are other methods that are still effective for that. And then of course the well-being of the species. So we're not gonna serve fish from endangered or threatened stocks.
Mm. Right. I understand you guys follow the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch and also the NOAA, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration by the U.S. Department of Commerce. It's called NOAA, NOAA. And I think, well, these are, you know, the two categories of wild-caught farm. Is you have to maintain the healthy population. There's no decrease of it. And it's a balanced population of each species. And then also, I think some people argue you have to consider the human rights experts around the whole world to evaluate, you know, labor conditions of people who works in the seafood industry, all those things. So I think it's a lot to cover, and you have to research a lot because it's very difficult, right? It's not like a clear cut. How factory manufactured labeling thing. So do you look into it like as much as you can when you procure seafood?
Oh yeah. There is one of the benefits of sourcing all North American seafood is that that third tier of labor rights or the human side of it is, I know what you're talking about, but that doesn't really come into play for us. But yeah, every species gets analyzed through those criteria.
Right. Well, that's another thing, right? It's very hard to get the real information, transparency when it comes to especially seafood. And even if you get something expensive from Tsukiji, people say it's not the fish as labeled. And you are informed that, and you pay for a lot of money. So, yeah, seafood is very tricky, but I think you're still trying to do something right in this challenging environment. So I really appreciate what you do. And hopefully you can inspire other chefs and industry people too. So do you see any changes in availability of sustainable seafood in America lately?
The thing that I've noticed the most is the growing number of fish farms in the 6 or so years that I've been doing this. The two that come to mind that are the best examples are there's the Steelhead Trout Farm in Hudson, New York, and the Hiramasa, the Yellowtail Amberjack Farm in Maine. Those didn't exist when I started, and those are two fish now that are just staples of the menu. They're as good as it gets in terms of sustainability, and fantastic fish that are, now just so important for what we do. So that trend I see increasing. The one other advantage that we have sourcing sustainable seafood in the U.S. is easier than it probably is in a lot of other places, because the United States has some of, if not the strictest regulations when it comes to catching fish. So the availability of sustainable seafood, if you're getting fish from the US or from North America in general, there's a ton of it out there. But I don't go grocery shopping, so I don't know what it looks like from that. Like, if you go to a grocery store, I don't know what that looks like. But this, I probably see things through kind of a skewed lens, because I exclusively look at North American seafood. So to me, it looks like almost everything is sustainable. But if you take a step back and look at fish on a more macro level, that's definitely not the case.
I think it's going to take a long time. Like, building a sustainable seafood farm, it will cost a lot of money and also takes time, and also has to be inspected, I guess, to be recognized as sustainable. So yeah, it's a slow process, but it's great, exciting to know that there are more sustainable fish farms in America. And so I think, Jeff, you've been talking because you are one of the greatest experts in this field, and you manage two restaurants. And I think you really, I hope you can start lecturing around the world or to inspire people.
I'll sign up for that lecture.
I would love to. I definitely didn't like, I love sushi. Like, sushi is really what I love in restaurants. I didn't expect to be here in terms of, I didn't expect to be a sustainable sushi chef or anything like that. I consider myself a sushi chef. But it's just, this is just the path that I found myself on.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said earlier that you wanted to keep your sushi counter clean, means something you feel clean about ethically and also taste-wise. And
absolutely,
you know, the transparency, that's the cleanest of your sushi. And I know how it tastes like, so it's amazing. All right, so we'll take a quick break here. And then when I come back, we'll dive into how Jeff and James serve sustainable sushi to their guests. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian, to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and their rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, and my guests today are Jeff Miller, the chef owner of Rosella and Bar Miller in East Village, New York, and James DeMappitt, executive chef at Bar Miller. All right, so let's talk about your sustainable sushi restaurants. So Rosella and Bar Miller, which you opened with your longtime partner and beverage director, TJ Provenzano, in 2021 and 2023, respectively, and both located in East Village in New York, kind of adjacent locations. So first of all, what is the concept of Rosella, and what kind of menu do you offer at Rosella?
Rosella is a sushi restaurant kind of masquerading as a wine bar. It's meant to be, my vision for it, before we had ever opened it, was to be a very approachable, comfortable neighborhood sushi restaurant. Over the last 10 or 15 years or so, the proliferation of omakase sushi has been fantastic, but also I just kind of missed being able to go out and have a more affordable but high quality sushi meal. So, that's what I intended Rosella to be, and I think that's what it is. There's a lot of sushi and a lot of non-sushi items on the menu, but I think that the non-sushi stuff is kind of sushi adjacent.
Right. Okay, so kind of casual, approachable place, but you serve sustainable sushi as well.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, so let's dig into your new restaurant, Bar Miller. So what is the concept of Bar Miller, and what kind of menu do you offer at Bar Miller?
I think Bar Miller is an extension of Rosella. It very much comes from the same place spiritually and ideologically. But I think both Jeff and I wanted to see what that concept looked like in omakase form, because that's something that's near and dear to our hearts. At the same time, we wanted to be a little bit more experimental and offer maybe some selections that wouldn't be sustainable to offer to the kind of volume of guests we're doing at Rosella. And in that way, it's a fun opportunity to explore like lesser known cuts, lesser known techniques, maybe techniques that take a little bit more time to execute. And because of our lower guest count and more intimate dining room, we're able to explore that with relative ease.
Right. So you said omakase. So how do you describe omakase versus Rosella's a la carte menu?
So that's an interesting question, and it's one that continues to evolve. Jeff and I talk pretty much every morning and every night about menus and menu changes. And for me, it's not so much about a strict adherence to like a playbook or any one playbook, but kind of a respect to the purity of ingredient. When I think of omakase, there's certain dishes that stand out that we like to definitely put on our menus here. One thing would be like a chawanmushi is one of my favorites, and that's something that we have on right now. But in general, we don't try to limit ourselves or handcuff ourselves to any one definition. I think our most important, or I can't speak for Jeff, but my main goal all the time is to create an experience that highlights our fish in a way that doesn't obscure the flavor of the fish, but enhances it, but also showcases kind of our unique, like our love of just culinary techniques in general. And that doesn't even it's not limited to Japanese techniques. And I think it's a fun thing that we do things like at Rosella, we have a fish sausage slider, which is basically a smash burger. And that's just not something that you experience all the time. And I think it's like a fun talking point for the guests. And I think it's also additionally a great way to use up our trim and to minimize waste. And I think that's something that kind of like creatively drives us, the ability to utilize sustainability and the creative boundaries that imposes on us to create kind of new and fun things that you might not have ever seen at a restaurant like this before.
Mm, right. So the omakase means leave it to the chef. So you are fully in charge of what you serve, and guests are just waiting for what you serve. So you can be creative or you can be traditional, but what do you call your style of sushi at Bamila, James?
I would call it progressive omakase. I don't know if Jeff, I don't know how Jeff feels about it, but I definitely like, just for instance, a few hours ago, we were having like our morning talk about food, as we do like most mornings. And we were talking about putting like a literal fish taco on the menu with a nixtamalized corn tortilla that's freshly made, to order, which kind of calls upon my own culinary history and like the way that I learned to cook. Spending a lot of years in Texas, I cooked a lot of Mexican food, and I have such a love of masa. And I think there are so many corollaries between making a taco and making a piece of nigiri that are worth exploring. And it's kind of like those links that excite me a lot of the time. And that's something that I think doesn't even factor into the equation of this cuisine for most people. That's not to say that we're not reinventing the wheel here, but just the idea of being genuine to ourselves and kind of what excites us, I think is going to be palatable for most guests. And that's something that Jeff continues to encourage, and our results have been so far so good.
We're both pretty like playful, silly people, and I think at our best when it comes to our food, our food both at Bamila and Rosella is clearly there's clearly like a strong technical foundation, but we're also just having fun with it. I think Bamila to me is a bit of a playground. And I think I've already seen the menu over there evolve in just a few months. And I get pretty excited when I think about where it's going to be 6 months from now or a year from now. And when James says that we're like talking about, nixtamalized anything, that just means that he's talking about that. I haven't a clue. And that was when James was interested in coming out here to work here. That's something that I was so fired up about, because I've been in sushi for in May it'll be 17 years, and I'm just a sushi chef. And like James's background is so much more than that, and boy, it's so much fun to put our brains together.
We have probably too many ideas. I think the menu changes too often, to be honest, because we're like little kids. We're like really, really excited about every morning, like what lies in store for that day.
Mm. Right. Well, that's the point of omakase, right? You can play with it. You don't have to print the menu and you don't have to follow it. So, yeah. And then, for example, I had a fantastic dinner at Bamila, and one of the appetizers before even going to sushi, one of them, for example, that was dry aged fluke with sweet soy, apple, granita, rice puff. And it was flavored with olive oil. And it was amazing. I never thought of having apple granita and the fun rice puff on top. And the olive oil, which is completely not in the context of traditional Japanese sushi restaurants, but I was celebrating it. And that's what I think sushi probably needs from now on, to be more global, accepted, enjoyed. And why do you have to get stuck in a traditional style, right? So it was very traditional. definitely Japanese because of the sweet soy and other flavors. But I really thought that was a very exciting moment of sushi being abroad and making, I wouldn't say progress, but expansion. And it's developing on its own something else outside of Japan. So, yeah, I really think that your excitement, your creativity every day is going to keep going and then inspire Japanese traditional sushi as well.
It really means so much to hear you say that, and I thank you for that.
Well, I think I was not the only one with the, you know, other guests in the HC counter. There was a celebration. You know, it's a very fun energy. I think you personally also creates a lot of fun energy with the team members. And it's such a pleasant space. And funny, it was a former Mayonoki space, right? So it kind of returned to the original space and recreated something.
It sounds a little corny. I don't think I expressed this to Jeff enough even, that being back in that space really feels very special. And I know that it might not seem like it has a connection to the fact that Mayonoki started there, but once, like the from day one, it immediately felt like it was a homecoming. I was coming home to something that wasn't my home, like coming home for the first time. And it just feels right in there. And like, that makes it so much easier.
Right. So that's called destiny, probably. That space is still available. So, so in terms of like going back to the sustainability, what's the advantage of offering an omakase menu at Bamular to inspire people about sustainable sushi?
When it comes to the fish that we're serving specifically, there's a lot of specific advantages, but I think overall, it's such an easy way to stand out. And I hope that, like, right now it's an easy way to stand out because there aren't, it's hard to find an omakase restaurant serving anything other than primarily Japanese fish. I would love for that to evolve and be able to go to some other restaurants doing something similar where we can have some friendly competition and get some ideas and things like that. But yeah, for the time being, it's just that, like, both at Bar Miller and in Rosella, one guest after another, because in New York, there's so many experienced diners, and we just have one guest after another saying something like, I've never had this as sushi, or I would have never thought of this, or what is this? What is this fish? So that to me is the biggest advantage. There's also, in a practical sense, getting fish from Long Island versus getting fish from, say, Tokyo. That it's a very short distance to travel, which means we can get some fish in just incredible shape.
Mm, right, and also that's the nature again. Local fish that edomae sushi means. People created the sushi culture by cooking or making sushi from the fish by Tokyo Edo Bay. So that's exactly what it's supposed to be. And I mean, I really discovered many items at the Bar Miller. Oh, wow, this is amazing. And why didn't we have it before? But it's a related question, though. So bluefin tuna is a symbolic fish that carries an image of unsustainable, but you serve bluefin tuna at Bar Miller sometimes. So why is that?
So at Mayonoki, we never serve bluefin tuna, even though it by that time, the stocks of Western Atlantic bluefin, which is all that we serve here, those stocks were in good shape. The fishing restrictions over a period of decades had resulted in healthy stocks, which they are today. And it's because the symbolic nature of bluefin being the most notoriously overfished fish that we didn't do it. But the more I thought about it, obviously, like, bluefin tuna is an amazing fish, and it's a pleasure to serve it. But from an ethical place, or I don't know if that's even the right term, but if we're limiting ourselves to fish that are caught as locally as possible and from healthy stocks, why wouldn't we serve it? If it's just this sort of, if it's just the idea of it, and if it's because a lot of people have incomplete understandings of what it is, like, that's not a good reason. And then I also thought, like, how would I, if I were to explain that decision to a bluefin tuna fisherman from Massachusetts, how could I make that make sense? You know, these guys have had to follow the guidelines for years, for decades. And it's resulted in what those guidelines were put in place to achieve. So I actually felt like it would be, I got to a point where it seemed like it would be just backwards not to.
Right. So what I understand is you only serve a bluefin tuna, which is in season, and only a line caught, and the population would never be affected because it's in season, it's abundant, and then it's seasonal, and it's there's no bycatch, and the fishermen know what to do with them. So yeah, I think if it's you educate customers at a deeper level. Just because bluefin sounds like it's a bad thing, you need a better knowledge, deeper knowledge of what's good, what's not. That's why I think Monterey Bay Aquarium's seafood watch list constantly get updated. Like a Chilean sea bass, ones are totally almost endangered. It sometimes goes up, and it's a moving target. And I think we all sushi eaters have to be more aware of what's actually endangered. And just because it's served at the sushi restaurant, we have to know what you're eating. It's almost like just responsibility. So I think by serving bluefin tuna, you are kind of presenting the opportunity to learn. Let us think what to eat, what's right. So I thought it was a really cool thing to do. So anyways, so thanks for the great answer. And so who's your customer at Bamula, and what's the difference from Mozzella's customer?
We're still like coming to a place of understanding that. But I do feel like the guest at Bamula is almost specifically, I don't want to say a savvier diner, but oftentimes you get guests that have like exclusively go to omakase or go to maybe an omakase dinner a week. So, which can be an added layer of pressure, but it also affords an opportunity to have some real conversations about our ethos, about the food. And also just like you get a guest in that really understands what you're trying to do a lot of the time. Like we've had guests in our 4 months that come back once a month, and every time they're able to give me feedback that refines my own understanding of the menu that I made even, and the things that Jeff and I talk about, which is always really exciting. Also the environment in Bamula is a little bit quieter, a little bit more intimate. At Rosella, it's a little bit of a party atmosphere from top to bottom in the best way possible. Like I myself, I'm a huge fan of Rosella. I would say that the guest at Bamula is in for a more kind of like more one-on-one time and a little bit more of a quiet and contemplative meal, if that's what they want. And they're in for a lot of conversation with me if that's what they want. So I would say that overall, so far, it's been kind of a true experience of meeting like really, really like well-rounded New York diners, which for me is interesting coming from a place like Texas, where you might not see somebody who goes to a Michelin star restaurant with regularity, like ever, you know?
Right. Interesting, right? So because there's so many sushi bars right now, and then the more expensive places, they tend to be just, I heard, more kind of same kind of a wealthier population. But yeah, I think it's great to hear sushi eaters are becoming wider and probably younger, and they really get to know real sushi. So sounds exciting. And your place, I mean, East Village is a very casual and approachable place, but like the Bamiya's ambience was kind of quiet. It's almost like your own friend's place. We went to James' place. Yeah. And have a party. So it's quite party.
Ideally, we want to, it's like you're entertaining a guest at your apartment. Even the playlist is designed to be like the kind of playlist that you would have at home cooking for friends. And like, that's basically the vibe there. And one that I think like the decor and the ceramics and everything kind of plays into as well.
Mm, right. So, but what are the biggest challenges of running sustainable seafood restaurants, and how do you conquer these challenges?
I think, so when we first met Akiko, I think I was still in the midst of the most challenging part of that phase of my career, which was the combination of sustainable local seafood and sushi. There seems like to be a never-ending supply of books and guides of Japanese sushi fish, what fish to serve, what time of year, how to prepare each fish, what to look for, that doesn't exist for North American fish. So the biggest challenge by far was educating myself. And Mayanoki was just the best opportunity in the world to do that, because I had the freedom to order whatever I wanted and do with it whatever I wanted. And so in the 3-ish years that I was there, I kept track, and in the 3-ish years that I was there, I served 91 unique species. And part of that is because there's actually a lot more out there than I realized, but also I was looking at list after list of what fish was available. And any time that I would see something that I hadn't worked with before, I would order it, so I could get to know it at least a little bit. The biggest challenge was learning what to serve at what time of year and how to prepare it.
Mm. So being a pioneer sounds very hard.
It was hard, but like what, I don't know. I feel so lucky to have had that opportunity, and I'm still, it's not like I'm not continuing that process, but it's different now. I have a pretty sturdy foundation. I feel very lucky to have found myself in that position.
Mm. Well, as far as what I tasted, it's been very successful. You chose the right ingredients. You prepared. So, yeah, I mean, so far, it's amazing. And probably you can write a book about American sushi fish.
Oh, that's that is exactly my goal.
Mm.
I partly because I want to do it, I do have a writing background, but partly because if anybody beat me to it, I would be grumpy for the rest of my life.
Okay. So, well, I look forward to your new book coming before too long. Right. So, but you know, we discussed the challenges, but there are so many high quality sushi restaurants in the US, and the market is very competitive. So, what are the benefits of being a unique, sustainable sushi restaurant?
I think that definitely, I mean, Jeff touched on this a little bit earlier, but people are not ready for what we have to, like when they come in there, they have a conception that probably isn't what we offer. And sometimes like that could be considered a challenge. But as we move forward, I realize that it's actually working in our favor. I think a good example of that would be the way we serve something like bluefish, which is traditionally considered like a throwaway fish, and a fish that not only wouldn't be served like raw ever, but but even cooked, a lot of people would kind of thumb their nose at. It's an aggressive fish, but it's also like a fish that's sometimes considered a trash fish, which is a term that I hate a lot. And it's one of our favorites, especially like lightly dry aged and dressed simply. It's just a beautiful expression of what we try to do in terms of being a sometimes disregarded fish that has like a wonderful kind of oily, delicious flavor that people just kind of don't serve that way. And I think that moment happens many times in that meal.
Mm. I think it's a matter of time, right? In Japan, that kind of shiny fish, including a bluefish, it's a prized species, like a kohada in Japan. I think the price is really way more expensive than you can find here. I mean, a similar species, because shiny fish, that umami, kind of like a fishy oil that turns to umami, is the classic taste Japanese people are looking for. So
I think Jeff and I love like that. Like hikari mono is like our favorite.
I mean, that's like the essence of sushi. And one source of frustration for me is knowing that there are fish like that out there, but if they get used at all, they tend to get used as bait. So I have hopes and dreams that at some point we're going to develop or regain an appreciation for those fish. Mm. Because it's, the best example that I can think of is a fish called Blue Runner, which is abundant in the southeast of the U.S. It's like a perfect cross between an aji and shima aji. So just a little oily jack. And the handful of times that I've been able to get them, they are the best sushi fish in North America. But mostly they get used as bait for larger fish.
I want to be the larger fish.
Yeah.
It's funny. So there's, in Ginza, there are many expensive sushi restaurants. So Ginza is the highest recognized sushi town in Japan, even. But there's one tiny place that only serves shiny fish because the price is competitive. It's under the train rail station. And to get the seat there, it's like, I think it's 10 seats, something like that. You need a reservation month in advance. So that's how people price the bluefish in Japan, the real sushi eaters. I think it's a matter of time. And like a tuna, toro used to be thrown away. I think bluefish is going to be probably more expensive than a prized fish, I hope. And it's definitely the most sustainable way to consume sushi.
I think you're right. I think our collective palate as a culture is evolving. If you see the rise in popularity of just tinned fish, for example, that's something that I don't know, 10 or 20 years ago was not highly regarded the way that it is now, not sought after the way that it is now. So I think that there's a taste for it, just maybe not yet the knowledge and not the awareness of a demand for it that causes fishermen to catch and bring in those particular fish.
Mm, well, that's a good point, because other Western restaurants, famous like Prune to some other restaurants, served tinned fish just out of with the can itself. It does tend to be like sardine and really good oil. That itself is tasty. People started to realize it. So, okay. So in order for us, especially for the future generation, to keep enjoying fish, sushi fish, it's important to think about sustainable sushi. So how do you think you can promote sustainable sushi in the U.S. and maybe the world?
I think that like our main goal is to just make sure that our practices are on point and in keeping with like what our conscience, our moral conscience, our ethical goals, and goals as culinarians tells us, we don't try actively, and Jeff, I might be like speaking over here, but we don't actively try to kind of proselytize to people about sustainability. We definitely, you know, if people have questions and want to be educated, that's something we engage in. But it's really more about incorporating it into your day-to-day life. And I think slowly, over time, I've noticed our guests are doing that. A lot of people find us because we're an omakase restaurant, but equal amounts of number of people find us because of the core of our ethos is sustainability. And I don't know, Jeff, do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add to that is, and this is something that is a more general statement and not just us, Bar Miller and Rosella. If the focus is on sustainability first, or rather if that's what you're advertising your product as, I think that it turns as many, if not more, people off as it does attracts. I think the sustainability element can be built in, but the quality, you have to be serving something that makes people want it. And in some ways, I think it's just a matter of time, because what we're doing here, making the most of what's local and abundant, is not, it stands out in sushi, but it doesn't stand out in other cuisines. And I think we are in this country, in the West, still relatively early in our growth, in our understanding of what sushi is. I think a lot of other cuisines are a lot more developed. There's been established traditions in America, in the West, for longer, and so those, where we are today in French or Italian or whatever else, there are so many versions of it, so many chefs who worked for the greats and then had people work for them and so on. So I think in a number of years, the idea of sushi as this thing that is very, very, and should be very Japanese, I think that's going to evolve and kind of fade away. Mm. Not to say that there won't. I this is really like looking into the future. I don't doubt that there will still be so many traditional Japanese sushi restaurants, but I also think there are going to be many other versions.
Mm. Right. So that's interesting, right? Because if you try to be sustainable and try to eat sustainably, it's almost like, let's eat healthy, and nobody wants to do
right,
it.
Right.
And but I really want to stress that Japanese people traditionally has never been depleted any species, because it's local and seasonal. And if it's something very special, you have to pay for it. And it's not the sushi culture. You just call in, there's a sushi delivery, and it's seasonal, it's a local sushi restaurant, it's reasonable. That's how sustainably we've been eating in Japan. And expensive sushi restaurants, like let's just get this bluefin from Oma or whatever, that's the thing that becomes very unsustainable. That's the misconception, and I think we have to correct it here.
So I think the easiest way to fix that for me personally, it was a mental switch, but there is no one ingredient in the restaurant that has to be on the menu. Like if we learn tomorrow that any number of fish are no longer available, no longer meet our criteria, we'll switch to something else. Think once I got in the mindset of like let's just see what's available and make the menu from that, rather than have an idea for what the menu should be and then go seek out the ingredients to complete it. Once I just start, it's more of a like ride the wave kind of mentality, and I I think it's a lot more fun, and it does require you to think on your feet a lot more, but I think it's an easy solution.
Right. And also easy on your wallet too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Okay. So do you see more sustainable sushi restaurant in America or anywhere else than, I don't know, compared to a couple of years ago?
The first name that comes to mind is Bamboo. They're based in Portland. I know that they've expanded, but I haven't seen. I'm not going to say that there aren't more, because maybe we just haven't seen them. But I haven't seen more. The one that I was the most excited to visit in New Haven in Connecticut, Mia's, closed a few years ago. So I don't know. We might be moving backwards for the time being.
Right. Okay. Well, we had a Hajime Sato from the Sozai in Michigan. And he said, if you can get just sustainable seafood in Michigan, you can do it anywhere. So he's really one of the very few people I knew other than you guys. So yeah, hopefully we can see more. Great.
I do know at some points, I think it's supposed to be this year, Keiji Nakazawa is opening his restaurant in New York, in Midtown. But I highly doubt that sustainability is going to be a factor there at all. But I do think that based on like what his restaurants have looked like in the past, he'll be making the most of local seafood, and I think that has a chance to really be a game changer, because he's on the Mount Rushmore of sushi chefs.
So yeah, that's exciting. Sounds like there's a movement, and very healthy movement, of eat local, sustainable, and delicious sushi. And you guys are having such a big fun at Bamula, and I really, really enjoyed every single dish. I could just really describe what I liked, but the timing is running out, so I will save it for maybe the future episode. But so what are your plans and dreams?
Well, so for me, I feel like it would be great, speaking on the topic of sustainable sushi, to grow. And this is me, like, Jeff and I have never talked about this, but it would be great to grow Rosella and this group into something that could be all over America, and find a way to kind of grow this in a way where sustainable sushi can be a thing on both coasts. And if we were at the forefront of that, that would be wonderful. But I mean, just knowing that kind of energy would be spreading would be something meaningful for me, and not just in terms of the food, but the quality of life for the staff. And I think that's something that's incredibly important for myself and for Jeff, making sure that people are learning. We have a lot of young cooks coming up with us that I think are experiencing things that I didn't get to, and maybe Jeff didn't get to, as young cooks, because there was a culture of kind of you have to earn the right to touch the fish, and that might take years. And I have no bitterness about that, and I think that it was a character building for me. But I also think that it's a meaningful experience to teach somebody who might have only been cooking for 2 years how to butcher a fish and cut fish, because that's just another way where we are kind of spreading the gospel. Sounds like a little bit of a self-serious term, but of what we do, of sustainable fish, of the sushi that we're trying to promote. And we try not to gatekeep any of that information. So we have a lot of young cooks that are learning things and getting their hands on ingredients and procedures that we probably didn't get to learn for the first 2 or 3 years of cooking ourselves. And to keep promoting that would mean a lot to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually though, if you guys have bigger, kind of business purchasing power, I think fishermen might change their mindset. And I heard when you expanded from Rosetta to Bamula, actually TJ Provenzano, your partner, he said you guys are able to buy the fish as a whole rather than the pieces, right? So that's like there's a scale economy. And also if you keep expanding, there is a demand. You inspire other sushi chefs probably to change the whole distribution system mindset. So that's my dream, taking over yours.
I'm completely on board with everything you said.
Yeah. So what about you, your dream, Jeff?
Definitely the book, which is, you know, it is, there's a version of it that's already in existence. So it's not like, that's not just a dream, but right now, this is actually coincidentally very in line with what James was saying. Right now, my focus is fully on the restaurants here in the East Village and refining, looking at all the details and refining in so many different ways. A lot of that just comes down to sharing what's in my head with the people who work here. This is such a different situation to be in than when I was at my Enoki, and it was really just me explaining things to our guests there every night and making the decisions myself. Now there's, I don't know, there's something in the vicinity of 20 people who work at Rosella and Bar Miller, and there's so much. What we do, what we do day to day, I think works, makes people happy, and that we feed them and we pour them drinks and we're hitting the steps of service and that. But I just want to keep doubling down on getting the ideas into helping the people who work here understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. And it sounds simple, but you know, as you hire one person after another, and you're also just doing all of the work that goes into keeping these restaurants running, it doesn't happen automatically. You really have to go out of your way to do that. And it's something that has been kind of, it feels like a fairly recent transition for me from going to employee to employer, and there's a lot of growth that has come with that, but a lot that still remains to happen.
Right. So it's like multi-layers just added to your life, because it's not just running the business, right? The human like philosophy and everything combined, and it's almost like I don't know, volcano erupted in your life.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, what a fun volcano, but yes.
Yeah. Right. What is you guys' life being challenging, right? When making sustainable seafood more popular and fun and delicious. So what keeps you going?
For me, it's everything that makes it difficult is everything that makes it fun. I think when you've engaged in a practice long enough and gain a sort of kind of ease of work, nothing could be more of a joy than encountering a bunch of challenges and then coming up with creative solutions that also are delicious. And the second thing would be finding new products, sometimes that we didn't even know existed. For instance, I think we'd be remiss not to mention that we get our rice from the Hudson Valley, which I think is really special, because a lot of the time, all of our fish is really local, New York even, and to serve a piece of New York fluke with New York fish is something I've never done in my career. I think that's like kind of a magical experience for the guests as well, to know that in some instances their fish was farmed right where their rice was grown, which is, I think, really special. And I'm trying to mention it every single time. And I think a lot of people get that as well, but definitely those two things. I think just like being challenged every day. And then for the most part, because we have such a good support system, and because we have each other, it's just like most of the time, none of these challenges are anything but kind of like the day's fun and like the beginnings of like something cool. And then the discovery of new products. Mm,
right. What about you, Jeff?
It's really never a question that I've had to ask myself When I was in, I went to school for journalism, and I had written for newspapers for a few years. But once I got into Dragonfly, once I got into sushi, it was pretty clear pretty quickly that I wanted to stay on that path. And at some point I thought to myself, let's see how far I can take this. But not like, partly as a challenge to myself, but mostly because it's so much fun. Like I wake up and I have since 2007, I wake up excited to come to work. So it's, I mean, sushi itself, my love of sushi itself is kind of the essence of what keeps me going. It's, I've never had to wonder like, why am I doing this?
Mm, right. So that's the famous term, ikigai, I guess. That's a hot word in Japanese right now. Yeah, great. All right. So, well, do keep me posted, and I hope you can come back and, you know, discuss your dreams, how it's progressing. So where can we find your updates online and on social media?
Oh, the increasingly active Instagram account, Bar Miller NYC. That's for Bar Miller.
We don't regularly update our Instagram right now, but we will be doing that more and more as 2024 progresses.
I, the one who is the least interested in all things social media, like I decided that I was going to take it upon myself to handle the Bar Miller Instagram account. And boy, does it look like it. I describe it as calm, but
yeah, it's very calm.
That's temporary. And then Rosella Sushi is Rosella's Instagram. And that's, yeah, everything that we do is posted there.
Okay. And also the website, barmiller.com and rosellanyc.com. These are the, right. All right, great. So thanks so much for joining us today, Jeff and James, and good luck.
Thank you so much.
I'm so happy to have been here once again.
Yeah, so come back soon. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikotema.com. Japanneeds is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Liam Warner, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week. Japanneeds is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.